Right, we've begun, and this will be a new Bible study. We've completed our some pre-Passover studies, and of course before that, we had, 14, 15, 16 weeks, whatever, looking at the book of Revelation, chapter by chapter and verse by verse, and not too many months before that, of course, we did the book of Daniel. So two major books of prophecy. And I think we'll probably leave prophecy for a little while. And what I want to do now is return to a topic that we've done at least three times before, possibly even more than that, which is the topic of living by faith. Now, faith is one of those aspects of our lives that does seem to cause us difficulties. I'm not altogether sure why that should be the case. I've got a rough idea, but faith is a very important topic. And today is the beginning of a new series, and the first message is entitled Faith, Why Is It Important? And you might say, well, we know why, and I think we should know why. Equally, we should be knowing how to live by faith in doing so. But in practice, we do seem to struggle a little bit. And I think it's one of those topics where it's very easy, in my view, for us all to grow cool. It's easy for us to slip back from living by faith into living by sight and living on the back of our natural, normal mind. And almost is one of those topics that we do have to continually work at. You continue to remain, if you like, spiritually fit, and refreshing our understanding of faith and reflecting on it and thinking about it, meditating on it and practicing it is necessary. I guess if we ever master the topic, we can leave it, but until we master it, we'll keep coming back to it, and hopefully every time we do, we'll build another piece onto the wall and get a bigger and bigger and better and more complete structure. So one of the biggest challenges I think that we all face is renewing our minds, because let's face it, you and I live in this world and we've all been programmed by what is actually a faulty system. This world, this society, this civilization doesn't work. It isn't working, and give it much longer and it would completely break down, and yet this is the world, this is a system that we live in, and we've been programmed to think by a faulty system. This system that we live in, Babylon, is broken. It's doomed. But on the other hand, it's what we're used to. It's natural to us. It seems right to us. You know, Jesus Christ didn't come to this earth when he first came to reform a broken system. He called us out of this world system, and he called us to teach us how to live, how to enjoy real life. Jesus said, I'm come that they may have life and have it more abundantly. So Jesus came to teach us how to live, starting now and then continuing all the way through eternity. And really, the way that you and I look at things, the way that we think, must change, because we've been programmed by this broken system, and Jesus has come to call us out of the world and teach us a new way. He wants us to live differently, to see things differently. You know, our natural mind, our carnal mind, isn't simply good enough. It's not good enough to live right. It's not good enough to succeed. It's not good enough for God's kingdom. It's not good enough for God. And yet that's the mind that you and I possess. And it's a mind that must change. Let's open our Bibles to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. And we'll begin when we get there in verse 5. Romans 8, 5. And we'll see as we read these verses that there are two very different minds being described in Romans 8. And you and I just naturally have one of these minds that you and I are to develop an other mind. Starting in verse 5, it says, "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit, they set their minds on the things of the Spirit." There are two different outlooks here, two different ways of seeing the world, two different ways of having values, two different standards. The way of the flesh, that doesn't mean just necessarily eating huge amounts of ice cream and chocolate, or chasing wild women. Those would certainly be part of the way of the flesh, but the way that just seems natural to us, the way our minds work, the way our neighbors' minds work, the way the world operates, that's the way of the flesh. And there are individuals, of which we would be certainly have started among them, who live according to a mind which is set on the flesh. But there are those, and we should be among them, who live according to the Spirit, and our minds should be set upon a spiritual outlook. We should have a spiritual perspective. Notice verse 6, "For to be carnally minded, to be fleshly minded, or even to be just naturally minded, is death. But to be spiritually minded is life and peace." And both of those would seem to be quite good characteristics, to enjoy life and to enjoy peace. And those are the outcome or the product of someone who is spiritually minded. And yet, that is not where we start. Our starting position, our default mode, if you like, is we are carnal, fleshly. But it says here that, you know, that way will lead inevitably to misery, to unhappiness, to sin, and finally, if you keep going that way long enough, you'll end up dead. But to be have a different mind, to have a mind which is a spiritual mind, is life. And Jesus said, "I'm come that they may have life and have it more abundantly," and peace. Verse 7, "Because the carnal mind," the mind that we just naturally possess, "is enmity against God. For it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be." The natural mind, the unconverted mind, the non-spiritual mind, actually, it goes contrary to God's ways. Verse 8, "So then those who are in the flesh," meaning are fleshly minded, "cannot please God." And of course, without faith, we cannot please God. And faith is something you won't find much of in the natural mind. For it says in verse 9, "Now you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his." And that's basic, and we know that. And if Christ is in you, interesting, if Christ is in you, I do wonder sometimes if we are conscious and aware that Jesus Christ ought to be dwelling in us, so that when we go places, Christ goes with us. When we lose our temper, Jesus is there, rather close, watching. It says, "If Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness. But if the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through his Spirit that dwells in you." And so, you and I should be moving from our fleshly minds, our carnal minds, our natural state of thinking, and conversion is all about our minds being converted, being changed, so that we have a spiritual mind. And that's not difficult in a sense if we have spiritual power. If Jesus Christ dwells in us, or verse 11 says, "If the Spirit of the Father dwells in us," then of course that Spirit should be giving life to our mortal bodies. Verse 14, "For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons and the daughters of God." So there's really no question, in a sense, that, you and I, since we probably all claim to have God's Spirit, or at least have God's Spirit working with us and upon us, if not yet in us, that you and I should be very different from the world around us. Because they don't have God's Spirit, and they will just live according to the flesh. They will do what seems right to them. They will rely upon their intellect. They'll rely upon their power of reason. They will rely upon what they see. They'll rely upon what they hear, what they feel, what they taste, because how else could they live? Before you were called and received God's Holy Spirit, how could you live? Well, you could only live by what you saw around you. The opinions that you heard on TV or the radio, or from your, families or your co-workers, your own great powerful mind looking at, weighing up and concluding, and you obviously, I would have thought, relied upon your five physical senses, and that's the natural mind. That's the natural way to do it. That's the way that most of us have experienced. But that's not the mind of God. That is not the mind of Jesus Christ, and that's not good enough to enjoy God's best. We turn to Proverbs chapter 14. And we'll read verse 12, one of those memory verses from years and years ago, Proverbs 14, and reading in verse 12, it says, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but his end is the way of death." And that's, of course, talking about the way that is natural. The way that the mind of man naturally works, the carnal mind, you could call it carnal mind, it just means fleshly mind, natural mind, or natural state. The way that looks right to us, the way that it seems right to us, the way that it makes perfect sense to our natural mind, actually doesn't take you very far, because it says its end is the way of death. So here's all these people out there in the world, and very intelligent people, very high IQs, very well educated in what's a flawed and broken system, and the way that seems right to them is the way that they follow. There are, you know, people who are quite rebellious in this world, that go the way they know is wrong. There's probably a few of those out there. But in general terms, many of the leaders and the thinkers, they're going the way they think is actually best for themselves, best for their communities, best for the world. It seems right to them. And they rely upon their what they see, what they hear, what they can measure. They rely upon their thinking. They rely upon the views of experts around them, and it seems so right. But the scripture says, actually, the way that man thinks is so good will take you to death, because that's the, if you like, the unconverted, unrenewed mind. Let's turn to Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. And here Paul is giving some, you know, plain instruction to the readers, to the brethren, people like you and me living in those days back in Rome. And he said, verse 2, "Don't be conformed to this world, to this society." One translation, the Philip says, "Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold." And yet, in reality, that's precisely what has happened to us in the past. We grew up in a society, and it taught us its ways. It taught us how to think. It taught us how to look at things. It taught us how to behave. We saw examples around us, our buddies at school, our parents, our relatives, people on the TV. And most of us, to one extent or another, we do get influenced by this society. Like the translation says, "Don't let the world around you squeeze you into his own mold, into his former shape. And yet, that's typically what will happen. But Paul says, but rather than letting the world shape you, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So Paul says, and this is one of the keys for all of us, is that you and I must be about this business. You and I must be about the business of having our minds renewed. It says here, be transformed. And which means to be transfigured. That's translated that way in other passages, to be transfigured. It means to be changed into another form, to be transformed. People that are interested in animals and insects and birds and bees and so on will use this term to refer to a caterpillar when he metamorphoses into a butterfly. You've seen a caterpillar probably, little wriggly thing on a leaf or a twig, and not terribly attractive, one has to say, a little fat slug-like thing. And not particularly nice to look at. You probably wouldn't want one on your arm. If you found one wriggling up your arm, you'd be sort of a bit, ooh, and flick it away in a hurry. But eventually, when it matures, a little caterpillar, does something miraculous. Out comes a beautiful butterfly. Fabulous colors, gorgeous to look at. Can fly through the air. Some of them can fly for thousands of miles. From little grub, little caterpillar, little slug-like thing, and it ends up a beautiful, gorgeous splash of colour flying for hundreds or thousands of miles. It's metamorphosed, it's changed, it's been transformed or transfigured. And Paul's saying here that you and I must be literally transformed. By what? Well, by our minds being renewed. The New Century Version says, be changed within by a new way of thinking. Well, that's not bad, is it? Be changed within by a new way of thinking. And you and I, it's not a joke. It's really what we're called to do, to be changed within. Have a new mind. And a new mind means a new way of looking at things, a new way of thinking. A new set of values. I mean, this society that you and I live in, to which we are exposed and to some extent conformed, only believes what it sees, does it not? You know what they're saying? Seeing is believing. We all know that. We've perhaps quoted in the past, seeing is believing. You don't see it, buddy, you don't believe it. If I can't put God in a test tube and measure him, I won't believe there is a God. When I see a miracle, I'll believe in miracles. That's just the natural mind. It has to see to believe. Even then it probably won't believe half the time. Has to hear, has to touch. If I can't see it, can't touch it, can't measure it, can't weigh it, I won't believe it. Because seeing is believing, and you and I should be familiar with that, because that's sort of where we've come from. And perhaps to an extent that's perhaps even where we still are. But it says here in verse 2 of Romans 12 that you and I are to be transformed by our minds being renewed. To be changed within by a new way of thinking. The way we think has to change. The way we look at things has to change. What's important, what our priorities are, has to change. Look at Ephesians chapter 4. And we'll start in verse 20. Ephesians 4, and picking up in verse 20. But you have not so learned Christ. So you and I are to be disciples, people who learn. And we should learn about how Jesus lived, how he walked, how he saw things, what was important to him. We should be learning from Jesus. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man or old woman, which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in righteousness and true holiness. Because Paul doesn't like short sentences, but that's not bad for Paul. But it says there's really two key things. One is we must put away from us the old man, the old ways, the old conduct. Put it off, put it away, like a garment. You know, if you get a sort of, you know, dirty garment on, you would undo the buttons, take it off, and throw it away. And that's the picture that Paul's using here. Take off this garment of the past, the ways of the past, and cast it away from you. Put it off. The old man, the former conduct, of which, of course, the natural mind that relies on what it sees and hears and can touch has to go. And it says, put on the new man, a new way of thinking. And verse 23 says, be renewed in the spirit of your mind, meaning be made new. So, you know, I can't just continue as we were before, you know, BC, before conversion. When we've been called and been converted, it's a process. And we are to be transformed. It's a continuous process. We are to be changed. Be renewed in the spirit of our minds. You know, one of the problems you sort of detect looking around God's people over the years is that we have been fairly good, possibly even very good, at the acquisition of spiritual knowledge. There are probably few groups on the earth today that have as much knowledge of biblical doctrines as the people of God. We all know about the Sabbath. We all know pretty much how to count to Pentecost. Pretty much. We all know about the immortality of the soul, the spirit in man. We know about Christmas. We know about Easter. We know about Lent. We know about the Trinity. We've heard about hypostases and things. We know a lot of things. I wouldn't doubt that among the people of God are some of the most knowledgeable of the biblical teachings that there are. And yet, perversely, there are many, many lives among God's people which are a complete mess. Families and individuals whose lives are disaster areas, poor relationships, divorces, remarriages, people who are anxious and stressed out, or poor, or sick all the time, or people who are downright arrogant and rude and selfish and spend all their so-called Christian lives pointing the finger, fault-finding, and being bitter and twisted, and then saying that it's all down to God. And one of the, so, you know, this is quite, in a sense, quite dismaying, that God's people know so much and yet are terribly immature in the quality of their lives. And one of the biggest changes that we need to be making in our lives is renewing our minds. And one of the big parts of that is learning to live by faith. Living by faith, learning to live by faith, is a major part of renewing our mind. Because it's such a completely different way of living. It's a different way of life. The natural mind, the carnal mind, the fleshly mind goes entirely by what it sees, hears, can taste, can touch, the opinions of others, the weight of opinion. And that's not the way God's mind operates. That's not living by faith. And when Jesus was here, he lived by faith. He still does, for that matter. The example he set is the way that you and I should be learning, developing, maturing, having our minds renewed. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And verse 7, very short verse. And Paul says, for we walk by faith, not by sight. I suppose the question would be, do we? What is it that determines your actions, my actions? What is it that makes us do one thing or another? What we see, or what God has said in His Word? And we can do either, can we? There are two ways there, at least. There's the way of faith and the way of sight. There's a choice. You can do either. I can do either. You can choose to walk by faith. You and I can choose to rely on and walk by sight. Which one will it be? Well, of course, I guess some of us are more predisposed to walk by sight. Some do it all the time. Others might occasionally walk by faith, but frequently, you know, fall back and walk by sight, particularly if things don't go well in a hurry. And perhaps there are a few out there who are mature and who walk by faith. It's their way of life. And minds have been renewed. You see, the renewed mind of a person being transformed, the renewed mind, the mind that's been made over in God's image, the mind which is empowered by God's Spirit dwelling in that person, the renewed mind is a mind that walks by faith. And that's now the natural way, if you like, that person walks. They have a choice, but they habitually choose to walk by faith. If there's ever any dispute between what they see and hear and what God has said in His Word, it's a simple choice. God's Word gets priority all the time. Every time, every situation, they walk by faith. They make that choice. Look across at chapter 4, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Same page for me, that's why I said look across, but of course for you it might be over the page. Starting in verse 16. Therefore, says Paul, we do not lose heart. We're not discouraged. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. Which, if you think about it, that's pretty good news. You know, the days and the years come and go. And sometimes the mirror does just let you know that perhaps gravity is taking over. And perhaps you see a few more lines and a few more wrinkles and the odd grey hair sprouting out. And so on. And the outward man is going to age somewhat. But the inward man... Well, it says that's renewed every single day. It's being renewed day by day. So spiritually, we should never grow old. We should never be sort of stop learning, stop growing, stop maturing, because our inward man is fed from the Spirit and is renewed day by day, by day by day. And our outward form might start to age a little bit, but our inward man, nope, as strong, in fact stronger when we're 95 than when we were 25, because it's renewed every single day, getting stronger and stronger. But carrying on, verse 17, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while, and here it comes, we do not look at the things which are seen, but we look at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, subject to change. But the things which are not seen are eternal. So here Paul says, you know, folk, he says, we, him and his colleagues, but it should apply to all of us, we don't look at the things that are seen. They don't motivate us. They don't turn us around. They don't distract us. We don't base our lives on things we can see, because the things that are seen are temporary. Even a, you know, castle in England or Wales, built of huge big boulders and rocks and stones, been there 500 years. But come back in 10,000 years, it won't be there. All the things which are visible to you and I, buildings, trees, people, cars, boats, all those things are temporary. They will change. They will pass away. But there are some things that are eternal, and that's the truth of God, and God's Word, and God's promises. So says Paul, verse 18, we do not look at the things which are seen. We don't walk by sight, in other words, but we look at the things which are not seen, the invisible things. That's what we see. Of course, you need an eye of faith to see that, but Paul says we look at and we're motivated by the things which are not seen, the invisible truths. And so Paul had clearly developed, if you like, the right mind. His mind was well renewed by God's truth, and it was Paul's way of life. He chose to live by faith. He chose to be influenced by God's word, by what God had said, what God had promised. And no matter what the physical evidence might say, Paul says there, you know, that our light affliction. So there were clearly times when Paul was under pressure. He says, our light affliction. Well, sometimes Paul was stoned. He was chased out of town. He was lowered in baskets over walls. He was, you know, shipwrecked and floated about the sea. He said, well, I'm not bothered by that. I'm not moved by that. That's not going to depress me or turn me away. That's temporary. I don't look at those things. Those things aren't going to make a difference to me. My eyes of faith are fixed upon the eternal truths of God. His word, his promises, his faithfulness, his dependability, his compassion, his goodness. And those things, they will never change, ever, ever, ever. And so, you know, Paul lived his life in faith, lived by faith. Go down to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, and starting in verse 36, it tells us how important faith is for you and for me, because we read here, for you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Good, going to receive the promise, that's good news. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, that's someone who doesn't live by faith, because if you pull away and draw back, then you're looking at something other than God's word. It says, my soul has no pleasure in him. God has no pleasure in people that turn away and draw back and don't walk with him. Verse 39, but we are not of those who draw back to perdition or destruction, but of those who believe, have faith, to the saving of the soul. But really it's verse 38, to concentrate on for a moment. Now the just shall live by faith. The just shall live by faith. And that's really what faith is. It's what you and I are to be living by. You can't live fully without faith. And faith isn't something that just comes and goes. It's not something that is just temporary. It's real, not sort of oozy woozy. You know, faith is something that we live by. The just, the righteous person. And who's that going to be? Well, hopefully, we ought to be able to say, well, I'm a righteous person. I'm a just person. Because if we don't think we are, we've got some work to do. But if that is the case, that you and I are the just or the righteous, then it says that you and I are to live by faith. And I suppose a good question is, do we? Do we? Would you say that you're a person who lives by faith? Well, we ought to. You know, faith allows us to live on a higher plane. You know, Jesus said, I'm come that may have life and have it more abundantly. But it requires faith to live that abundant life. And it says here, again very plainly, the just shall live by faith. You and I live by breathing air. Without that, we wouldn't live very long. And you and I need to live by faith. It should be part and parcel of how we operate. We get up in the morning and we're living by faith, making decisions by faith, talking by faith, planning by faith. It says the just shall live by faith. It's not something that you just do once in a blue moon. I think very often people live by sight for about 360 odd days a year, And then somewhere in the year a crisis erupts, might be a health problem, might be perhaps a fire from your job, might be perhaps some sort of major other issue intrudes into your otherwise, you know, routine and mundane life. And then suddenly, after 360 days of walking by sight, suddenly, now, I need an answer from God in a hurry. Now I better find some faith. Where was it again? I left it. And we sort of look in a cupboard, and out comes the old faith thing, and we blow some dust off it, and then we're going to charge up to heaven and beleaguer and battle with God to deliver us, because once a year we think we've got to get some faith to get an answer. Won't work. The just shall live by faith. It's the way that they live. It's not something that is added on here and there. It's how they live. They are people of faith. They live by faith. They eat by faith. They sleep by faith. They live by faith. And that's what you and I are to be aiming for. And we're in Hebrews, look down at chapter 11, verse 6. Chapter 11 and verse 6, a very well known scripture. Been here about 9 million times in the past. Don't exaggerate, Jamie, only 8 million. But without faith, it says, it is impossible to please him. Talking of God. Without faith, it says, it's not possible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and most of us could do that, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And there are some people who think you diligently seek God and he'll never reward you. Not until it's by and by when you die in the sky. But if you come to God, you must believe that he is and that he responds. He's a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. So again, it says in verse 6, without faith, it's impossible to please God. And is that because if we have faith, it sort of gives God some sort of selfish pleasure? Oh, I'm glad they've got faith. You know, well, how nice they've got faith. And as he's sort of ticked off in some way, if we don't have faith, oh, they haven't got faith. Oh, I'm annoyed with them. Is it a question of pleasing God in that sense? No, I don't think so. But, you know, the issue is that God is a good God. God is a giver of every good and perfect gift. God wants to bless. God has much he wants to give you. God has much he wants to give me. But without faith on our part, he can't. God is not able to just dump blessings on us like some sort of favoritism. Of course, we'd like it that way. Yeah. You and I do absolutely nothing at all. Sit there in front of the TV set with our remote, charging from channel to channel, and God dumps blessings on us. As we do nothing at all. But no, God has required faith. And without faith, God cannot get the blessings to us he wants. So how can he be pleased if he can't bless us, and he desires to bless us, wants to give to us, wants to share with us? Yet God is pleased when we believe him. Surprise, surprise. When we trust his word, when we rest on his promises, then God is empowered to make them good. So without faith it's impossible to please God, because God cannot give us what he wants without the faith. Faith is a means whereby God can legally bless us. And so you can understand that, you know, a God who wants to give, who is a good God, who cannot give because the faith isn't there, of course God's not pleased. We're preventing him from doing what he wants to do. He set up the system. There must be faith, but without that, God's hands, in a sense, are tied, and that certainly cannot please him. And so he wants there to be faith. It opens up the channel for him to do what he wants to do. Look at Mark chapter 6, because an example where we've been before, where, you know, Jesus was unable to do what he wanted. There's nothing new in this this process. Chapter 6 of Mark, and beginning in verse 1. Then Jesus went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? And what wisdom is this which is given to him, that such mighty works are performed by his hands?" They were hearing reports of what Jesus did in other towns in the Galilee. Verse 3, "Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And they were offended at him, because they thought, "We know this guy. He's the carpenter. He's the contractor that just lived, you know, two roads away. We know his mother, Mary. We know his brothers and his sisters. This guy's come from here. Who does he think he is?" And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his own country, among his own relatives, and indeed in his own house." Verse 5, "Now he could do no mighty work there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them." Now, he said before, that's quite a surprising statement. It doesn't say he would do no mighty work there. It says that Jesus, the Messiah, filled with power and strength, who'd raised the dead, given sight to the blind, cleansed the lepers, done all that in other places, it says he could do no mighty work there in his own hometown, among his own sort of relatives, his school buddies. He could do no mighty work there, except he laid his hands on a few sickly people and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. Their lack of faith prevented Jesus from doing what he wanted to do. Jesus was as compassionate towards the needy in his hometown as he had been anywhere. Jesus was the giver. He was the healer. He wanted to set people free in his own hometown in Nazareth as much as anywhere else in the entirety of Judea and Samaria. He hadn't changed. And Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But here he is in his own hometown, and what can he do? Virtually nothing, because of their complete absence of faith. He marveled because of their unbelief. The Amplified says of verse 5, "And he was not able to do even one work of power there, except that he laid his hands on a few sickly people and cured them." So a few minor ailments, but the big miracles, the great displays of compassion and power, couldn't do it. So in Hebrews we read that without faith it's impossible to please God, and that's because God cannot heal, cannot prosper, cannot give peace, cannot open doors if there's no faith. And of course that displeases God. And here it says, verse 6, Jesus marveled. Well, I think you could add in brackets there, "and was greatly displeased." Because Jesus is, you know, he's motivated by compassion. He sees people with needs there. He wants to respond to them. He wants to heal. He wants to cast out demons. He wants to do the great things he's done elsewhere, bring blessings. But in the absence of faith, he can't. Not that he wouldn't, he actually can't. So you and I ought to be able to see that, you know, living by faith is very important. Without faith we can't please God, and without faith God cannot act, cannot do what he wants to do. Let's turn to James chapter 1. You know, all of us have got individual needs in our lives, different backgrounds, we're all different ages, some are male, some are female, we've got all manner of needs, and we'd like God to intervene. We'd like God to provide direction, wisdom, healings, prosper us, bless us, direct us, protect us, guard us, guide us, all those things. But you and I have to live by faith, because God operates and acts on faith. And if there's no faith, then it prevents God doing what he wants to do. Look at James chapter 1 and beginning verse 5. "If any of you lacks wisdom," and let's face it, there are times when we certainly do lack wisdom, don't know where to turn, don't know what to do next, not sure which direction to go in. It says, let him ask of God, who gives to all, liberally, generously, and without reproach, and it will be given to him. So that's pretty clear, and that's a promise, really. Ask God for wisdom. It says he will give it liberally, which means, you know, generously, and without reproach. God doesn't wag his finger and say, what a stupid request that was. I mean, you must be a real moron to ask that sort of question. Where have you been all your life? Like, God doesn't reproach us and look down on us. I mean, God knows everything. Been around for eternity, and you and I have been here about 5 minutes and know virtually nothing. And so, you know, God doesn't hold it against us. If we come with any request that even might be, you know, very strange, God gives wisdom liberally. No reproach. It will be given. But then verse 6 starts with a but. Uh-oh, when you say a but, then you know we're in trouble. Yeah, but. And we've all been through that. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. And we've probably all stood by the seashore and, well, it's a stormy day and seen the waves, and they're all over the place, aren't they? Up 1 minute, down the next. Blown to the north, then the south, then the east, then the west, up in the air, splashing bits. Just total chaos. Not steadfast for a moment. All over the place. And it says, people who doubt are just like that. You know, they have no position. They don't hold a position for more than about, you know, 5 minutes. In the morning, they're, you know, strong in faith. Going to stand in faith until God delivers me. And 1 hour later, a letter drops to the letterbox, bad news in it, and I say, oh dear God, you know, and then straight away they're down in the dumps, but later on somebody phones them up and gives them encouragement, and they're back up in the air again, great, God will deliver me. Next day, bad news, down they go again, up and down, responding all the time to the flesh, what they see, what they hear, what they had pizza the night before, don't feel too good the next day, and suddenly their spirits are down. You know, that's not living by faith. That's just responding to every external physical pressure around you. It says, verse 6, let him ask in faith with no doubting. But he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. You know, a double-minded man is of two opinions. He's walking by faith 1 minute, by sight the next, and then swaps over again, and then again, and then again. God says, I can't give that man wisdom. In fact, it says there, verse 7, let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. So, is faith important? Oh, yes, because you and I do want to receive things from the Lord. And that says, if you and I are people who don't have faith, and if we are people who live in doubt, then it's going to be rather tricky for God to bless us, because his word makes it plain that he has to have something to work with. We have to give God something to work with. And there's a problem, if you're reading these verses here, looking at verses 5 and 6 and 7 and 8, does it suggest there's any reluctance on God's part to give this man wisdom? No, it says, verse 5, God will give wisdom liberally, generously, abundantly, copiously. No reproach. There's no reluctance on God to give wisdom or any other thing he's promised. God is a good God. God gives good gifts. There is no holding back on his part. There is no reluctance, but he has to have something to work with, and that's our faith. We hold out the faith that gives God the permission, if you like, the legal right to bless us. And, you know, so often we end up spending our time, you know, begging God rather than believing God. You know, begging, trying to move God and shift him from his position. You know, we know God's reluctant. We know he's not paying attention. We know he's looking elsewhere. If I can just beg, then maybe just once in my life I can push God into doing something for me. Which, of course, is a strange view to have of our God. But rather than begging, we should be concentrating on the believing. You know, believing God, having faith in God is important. Let's turn to Matthew 21. Well, the title of this message is Faith, Why Is It Important? Well, the answer is important because without faith, God can't do for us what he wants. Matthew 21. And God can't do for us what we want, for that matter. Matthew 21. And beginning in verse 18. We'll read this in two of the Gospel accounts. We'll turn to Mark in a moment. But Matthew 21, beginning in verse 18. Now in the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it but leaves, and said to it, spoke to the tree, let no fruit grow on you ever again. And immediately the fig tree withered away. Now we know from the Mark's version that it withered from the roots. And it was actually one day later when they saw the evidence of all the leaves all dropping off and so on. Verse 20, now when the disciples saw it, which was one day later, they marveled, saying, how did a fig tree wither away so soon? But of course, Jesus had spoken to the fig tree. And Jesus answered and said to them, assuredly, I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but also if you say to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, it will be done. And all things, whatever you ask in prayer, you will receive. No. But that's the way some people may think. All things, whatever you ask in prayer, you will receive. And then because they don't receive, now it's time to start begging and barraging and sending up mortars into heaven, try and shift God or wake him up or somehow get his attention or remind him of all the good things you've done in your life and all the tithes you've sent in and offerings and taking people to church and polished people's shoes and visited the sick and please, I deserve it. Anything other than what it says. All things, whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. Why is faith important? Because if you and I need things in life, then we have to be believers. Of course, it shouldn't be hard for believers to be believers, but you know what I mean. There are plenty of believers that don't believe, not very often. All things, it says. So this is Jesus, this is in red letters in my Bible. That's quite a comprehensive statement. All things, whatever. Now, that's not really limited, other than in your imagination. And a tradition that says, well, yeah, I know Jesus did all things, but didn't mean that, did he? He meant a few things now and then, once in a lifetime. Whatever you ask, well, yeah, but whatever you ask in accordance with the holiness, and whatever you ask as a religious person, certainly nothing selfish. And so, bit by bit, you know, people trim this down to the point where, in fact, there's nothing you ask believing that you'd receive. But take Jesus at his words, all things, whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. And it wasn't just what Jesus could do, because the verse above says, regarding the fig tree, assuredly, I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, so you could do that as well, says Jesus. You know, if you went up to a fig tree and spoke to it, it would work for you. If you have faith, it will work for you. But also, even if you say to the mountain, shift, it will be done for you. And all things, whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. Why is faith important? Because we want answers to our prayers. Mark 11 is the corresponding account from John Mark. Very similar, but one or two extra details. And we pick up in verse 21. And Peter, remembering, said to him, Rabbi, Master, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away. So Jesus answered and said to him, have faith in God. Or the Greek actually is, have the faith of God. Have God's faith. Have the God type of faith. have faith in God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, you know, some people say only Jesus could do this, but that's what they say. Jesus said something very different. He said, whoever says to the mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will come to pass, he will have whatever he says. Verse 24, therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, you will have them. Now again, that's not what it says. And we shouldn't omit what Jesus does say. Therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you will have them. If you and I don't, you know, follow the instructions, we can't expect to receive the benefits. Whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you will have them. And when do you believe you receive them? When you pray. You don't wait till you have them to believe you receive them, because you haven't got to believe when something's in front of your nose. You can see it. No belief required there. You believe you receive when you pray. Read it again, verse 24. Therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them, even though there's nothing to see. Believe you receive them, and you will have them at some subsequent time, which might be 5 minutes, or 5 hours, or 5 days, or 5 months, or 5 years, depending. If you ask him something really big, be prepared to stand for a really big period of time. But whatever things, says Jesus, whatever you ask when you pray, believe you receive it, because is faith important? Absolutely. If we don't believe, if we don't have the faith, if we just go around all over the place doubting and up one day, down the next, and so on and so forth, you know, God's hands, in a sense, are tied. Look at Mark chapter 9. Back a couple of chapters to Mark chapter 9. And we'll cut into the story, since time is romping away. But we'll come back to the story another day. But cutting in at verse 20, this is the man who brought his young son who was being sort of demon-possessed to the disciples, who had failed to heal him, thus proving that it wasn't God's will to heal. Verse 20, then they brought the young boy to Jesus, and when he saw him, he immediately the spirit convulsed him, the young boy, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. So Jesus asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, well, from childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, Jesus, have compassion on us and help us. If you know, disciples couldn't do it. You know, they've tried and they've given up. But if, Jesus, if you can do something, have compassion on us and help us. Well, you don't have to ask Jesus to have compassion. I mean, Jesus has compassion. Had it then, has it now, always will. But Jesus said to him, verse 23, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. So Jesus put it right back on the man. It's not a question of if I have compassion or if I can do something. It's a question of if you can believe. All things, it says, are possible to him who believes. All things, not just this particular incident here. Jesus says all things are possible to the one who believes. You know, this man was just thinking naturally. That's not a criticism of him. All he could do, he grew up in a carnal society, used to, you know, respond to what he saw and heard and was told by other folk. But Jesus said, if you can believe, all things are possible. You know, faith is important. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 9 and look at three illustrations in this one chapter. Matthew chapter 9 and beginning verse 2, we're just looking at three rather brief examples here in this one chapter of where Jesus said or showed that faith was important. And we know that without faith it's impossible to please God or please Jesus, who is, of course, also God. And if we want God to respond or Jesus to respond, you know, faith is rather important. Chapter 9, verse 2, and they, behold, they brought to him a paralytic lying on a bed. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said to the paralytic, son, be of good cheer, your sins are forgiven you. So Jesus saw the faith of these men. We said before, you know, how can you see faith? Well, faith without corresponding actions is dead, but equally, faith with corresponding actions is much easier to see. And Jesus could see there was faith here. These guys had brought this man, they'd lowered him down through the tiles of the roof, and Jesus saw their faith. And so verse 6, but that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins. Then he said to the paralytic, arise, take up your bed, and go to your house. And he arose and departed to his house. These men have been paralyzed for months or years, you know, unable to work, couldn't look after his family properly. But he had faith, his buddies had faith, and Jesus saw their faith, and he responded to their faith. That gave Jesus something to work with. And he says, get up. And he got up and went to his house. And when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, who had given such power to men. But the man's faith was there. Dropping down to verse 20. The lady who had the issue of blood for many years, her story, verse 20. And suddenly, a woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years, that's a long time, came from behind and touched the hem of his garment. For she said to herself, if only I may touch his garment, I shall be made well. Which is a statement of faith. By the way, she announced, if I can touch his garment, I shall be healed. That was what she believed. She had faith. And she took action. Didn't just stay in her little attic and bleed to death for the next few more years. She took action. Verse 22, but Jesus turned round, and when he saw her, he said, be of good cheer, daughter. Your faith has made you well. And the woman was made well from that hour. So Jesus said, your faith has made you well. It wasn't just a question of Jesus' power, because Jesus, it's evident, didn't know much about this. It was the faith of the lady that drew down, if you like, on Jesus' power. And he turned around, and when he found her, he said, well, actually, well done. Be of good cheer. You know, I encourage you. Well, great example. Your faith, lady, your faith has made you well. Is faith important? Obviously, dropping down to verse 27. When Jesus departed from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, Son of David, have mercy on us. And when he had come into the house, so by the looks of it, Jesus didn't stop. But I thought he'd have stopped out there and gone to meet them, but he carried on. I guess a little test to see how persistent they were and how definite they were. When he had come into the house, the blind men came to him, obviously being led by the hand, I would have guessed. And Jesus said to them, do you believe that I'm able to do this? Do you have faith? And they said to him, yes, Lord. Then he touched their eyes, saying, according to your faith, let it be to you. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, saying, see that no one knows it. But when they departed, they spread the news about him in all that country. So Jesus said, according to your faith, be it done unto you. Well, is faith important? I've always thought that, well, if they were just putting this on and just showing off to their bodies in a sense and just trying to be religious, then nothing would have happened. Empty words. But it wasn't. Jesus said, do you believe? And they said, yes, we do believe. All right, he says, according to your faith, let it be done to you. And their eyes were opened. You know, occasionally you'll find that Jesus steps out and performs what you might class as a sort of special miracle for other reasons, like sometimes, you know, raising the dead. And a bit hard for somebody who's dead to have much faith. But Jesus did it from time to time. But you and I don't want to be waiting for some sort of, you know, special miracle when Jesus actually taught us how to receive every time, when he wants us to actually grow in faith and live by faith. There'll be times in our lives that we want something urgent, something definite, and we can't just, you know, run to God in desperate need when we're panicking and when we're being motivated by more fear and desperation. The just shall live continuously by faith. You know, neither God nor Jesus are impressed by having little faith. Now, you and I might try and excuse it all away. Well, you see, God, it's been hard for me to have faith because, and then we trot out a list of excuses. But what we're saying is, actually, God, it's really hard for me to believe you. And of course, it's put it bluntly that way, is that, can't really say that to God, can I? Well, it's hard for me of faith, you see, God, because of this material world I live in, da-da-da-da-da. Well, break it down. You know, say what we mean. God, it's very hard for me to believe you. God, it's very hard for me to believe your word. God, it's very hard for me to believe that you mean what you say. Phrase that way becomes very uncomfortable. You talk about, I'm one of the people that can't really have faith. Ha ha ha. Well, that's not impressive. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 14. And all of us can grow from wherever we are at the moment. There's plenty of growing available. And you and I should be people who are strong in faith. So it doesn't matter if we're not great hearers of faith today, because all of us can grow. All of us can change. All of us can continue to renew our minds. It's where we think more and more like God does. When our minds are more and more spiritually minded and not fleshly minded. But we may as well realize that God's looking for us to be people who are strong in faith, because that pleases him. And in absence of faith, whilst we might excuse it and think, well, we're on the same boat, that's okay, you know, comfort in numbers, that doesn't really cut it with God. Matthew 14, and picking up in verse 28, this is the well-known story of Peter getting out of the boat and trying to walk over the water and succeeding, at least in the beginning. Peter answered, verse 20, and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Of course, Peter, well known, there are big mouth bass in the world, and there's big mouth Peter. So he said, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus, which is stunning. Walking on the water in the Sea of Galilee. Fantastic. But, here we go again, but when he saw with his eyes that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, oh, well done, Peter. Only the second person ever to walk in water. Amazingly good job, old boy. Well, of course, Jesus did nothing of the sort. What you see here is a rebuke. Right? Jesus was not pleased. He was not impressed in the slightest. He said, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And we might say, well, he couldn't really help it. I mean, the wind was blowing and the waves, and his little toes were getting wet, and nobody could walk in water. But the point is, Peter was walking in water. Jesus was walking in water. And if Jesus says, walk in water, we can walk in water. To doubt that in front of the master wasn't impressive, and Jesus wasn't impressed. That's only a little comment there. Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? But I think I can see what Jesus is getting at. He's not at all impressed. Let's turn to Mark chapter 4. So if you and I think it's okay to be of little faith, and Jesus isn't that bothered, well, I think he might be bothered. Mark chapter 4, another incident on the water. This time a little boat is not doing too well as the waves and the storm are beating about it. Mark 4 verse 37, and a great windstorm arose. Now surely nobody could complain here, because this is a great windstorm, this is a hurricane beating about the Sea of Galilee, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. So the boat's about to go under the water. Dreadful conditions. I mean, really, this is a time to panic, and justifiably so. But he was in the stern, asleep, on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" I think, ouch. Asking Jesus if he cares for you might not be a terribly wise idea. But then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, "Oh, that was a close shave. There's such a wind and hurricane. No wonder we almost perished there. What do you think, lads?" He said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" That's a strong rebuke. It wasn't just the sea and the wind that got rebuked there. It was this bunch of students. And he said, "How is it? How can it possibly be that you have no faith?" And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Still missed the point. Let's turn finally to John chapter 20. One more illustration of a rebuke to a man who had inadequate faith. John chapter 20. And beginning in verse 24, this is doubting Thomas. Not faithful Thomas. Thomas, hero of faith. This is Thomas, immortalized as Thomas the Doubter. Verse 24, "But Thomas called Didymus," which I think means a twin, "one of the twelve, was not with them when Jesus came the first time. The other disciples therefore said to him, 'We have seen the Lord.' But he said to them," humbug, "'unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, put my hand into his side, I will not believe.'" The man from Missouri, the show me state. "Unless I see it, unless I can see the holes in the hands, and I put my hand right into his side where the spear was, you won't get me believing." You know, seeing is believing, that's my motto. And he puffs his chest up, you know, "Nobody's going to fool me. I'm Thomas Didymus. Seeing, that's it. I see it, I'll believe it, boys." Verse 26, "After 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them." And I'm sure Jesus timed this deliberately. "Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, 'Peace to you, shalom.' And then he turned round and looked at Thomas. 'Reach your finger here and look at my hands. Reach your hand here and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing.' And Thomas, obviously red-faced, said to him, 'My Lord and my God.' And Jesus said to him, 'Thomas, because you have seen me now, you have believed. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed.'" You know, it wasn't good what Thomas did there. It was a bad example, similar to Peter on the water, similar to the guys in the boat. No faith, not willing to believe unless they've seen, relying on their physical senses. That's what's natural. And to be fair, you know, Thomas wouldn't be that different to many of us, perhaps. But it's not good enough. You and I are not called to continue in this world with a natural, carnal, fleshly mind. We've been called to have our minds renewed, to be transformed. And so we'll be looking over the next few weeks again at the topic of faith. We'll hopefully see why it's important. If we want to please God and receive answers to our prayers, have our needs met, then you and I should be a people who live by faith. And we'll see that feeding on the Word of God is one way in which our faith can be strengthened. And you and I do want to be a people who are changed from Sabbath to Sabbath and feast to feast, so that we do renew our minds and become ultimately, and there's no reason why we can't, by the way, you and I can be people who are strong in faith, heroes in faith, and as we are, of course, we will be completely pleasing to our God.